KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
Sometimes you're just tweeting away and it's not getting you anywhere. You see people and they have really great tweets and they're basically just giving away genius ideas or genius jokes just for free. And then you don't even technically own your tweets after you put them up.
Jesus Nice started out being funny on Twitter, but knew when it was time to get serious. He and the kid Mero explain how they worked their way from covert tweeting while holding down day jobs to the day job of their dreams, their own self-titled series on Showtime. But first, we banter. Stick around. It's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my associate in banter, Matt Bellany. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So, as we are speaking, Elvis is rolling out in theaters. Audiences are either going or not. We don't know exactly how much this movie costs. This is Baz Luhrmann. He hasn't made a movie in years, almost 10 years, but not quite. Last one was Great Gatsby. This movie is 2 hours and 40 minutes. They're trying to claim that it costs around $80 million, I think. I don't think you or I can believe it's anywhere in the neighborhood of that. I think much more. Interesting bet. You know, it just seems like a lot of money for a very long movie that I'm just not sure that people are going to be compelled to go to see. You know, Baz Luhrmann has a following, but his stuff is very stylized, and 2 hours and 40 minutes of it, I would say, is a lot. And he is threatening us with a longer cut that he says he has up his sleeve, 4 hours. So I don't know. The tracking is soft, and I don't know whatever the real number is. I don't see how Warner's gets out of this with a profit.
Yeah, it's a bizarre movie for summer because this is like a summer movie from 20 years ago where you could get away with doing a big splashy biopic without any pre-branded IP or explosions or anything like that and still do a number in the summer. And what we've seen coming out of the pandemic is that for the most part, you need something pre-existing to lure an audience. And the question for this movie is, who is this for? Because most people who care about Elvis are now in their 60s, 70s, and the younger audience that they might capture with a star like Austin Butler, who is younger and not that well known to the general public, do they care about Elvis? Do they, you know, does this music appeal to them? And I know I saw some footage at CinemaCon. I know they've really kind of gussied it up, but ultimately at the end of the day, you got to wonder who this is for.
Yeah, I mean, it would seemingly be more older audiences, I guess, but older audiences are not quite flooding back to the theaters yet, unless it's something they really, really want to see, like Top Gun. Top Gun has gotten past $900 million. That's a phenomenal number. I mean, obviously the movie is, people love the movie, but that is the career best for Tom Cruise, certainly. And for Jerry Bruckheimer, the producer who's done a lot of big movies, that shows that for the right thing, people will turn out. But I'm not sure this Elvis thing is the right one.
Yeah, the reviews out of Cannes weren't great. And yes, it has Tom Hanks, who is a real movie star, but he's in a fat suit. He's doing a weird accent. So it's kind of not an automatic lure. And we'll see. This is also the product of the previous regime at Warner Brothers. They're making a change under the new ownership from Discovery. And I don't know if they would make this movie. It's a weird situation they're in now because due to COVID and some of the scheduling problems they've had, this is the only live action movie from Warner Brothers this summer. I mean, they have an animated DC movie later, but they don't have Harry Potter this summer. They don't have a big DC movie. The Black Adam was moved to fall and Batman was in the spring. So this is it.
Yeah, I'm sure David Zaslav is studying this closely. Ironically, Mike DeLuca, the new head of Warner Film Studio, this actually seems like the kind of movie he might throw the dice on, but maybe not with David Zaslav as you know, heart bottom line oriented David Zaslav as his boss.
Yeah, I mean, he made a movie like this. He made Respect, the Aretha Franklin movie that came out and bombed last fall. And obviously that was the COVID situation was worse then. But, you know, I even think the Aretha Franklin songs are a little bit more relevant than the Elvis
definitely.
Music.
Yes, I would much rather. Yes. And also, I think that he made Gucci, which feels sort of like the same kind of camp thing that that Baz Luhrmann does. So, and that didn't do so well.
If you talk to Warners, they note that each Baz Luhrmann movie has grossed more than the previous one. And Great Gatsby, which is, you know, almost 10 years ago now, that one did about $350 million. Now, that one also had Leo DiCaprio, it had Kerry Mulligan, it had Tobey Maguire. Nobody is on that level. And that's a book that literally every high school kid has read. So it's a little bit different, but, you know, they think this movie will play throughout the summer and older audiences will find it.
Right. Okay. Now, I'm going to quickly mention a piece in the information about Ted Sarandos. And the piece was interesting in that it talked about this Mike Myers project that Netflix had made called The Pentaveret, which was not something that people at Netflix generally wanted to make. And this is something that Sarandos wanted to make. And this piece revealed that people talk about this as the Ted tax or Ted specials, things that Sarandos himself decides to make, even if it is not the consensus and there's no support for it in this among staff members. I'm just going to note that aside from the interesting idea of a TED tax, which I've heard versions of before, things where, you know, Sarandos has a relationship and does what he likes. This to me is like people are still talking, and I feel like the controversy at Netflix continues. You know, this comes from people who know what goes on inside of Netflix. Maybe they were kicked out recently, and you know, it is a continuation of the negative publicity that Netflix has been enduring, because, you know, there, it seems to me that people are kind of waging a campaign.
Yeah, I mean, heads of the companies making shows that they want to make because their friends made them is nothing new. But for Netflix being such a data-driven company, I guess people do get upset when they deviate for one executive's whims. And now people are more willing to talk about it.
Yes. So the TED tax is also a tax on TED. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, a founding partner of Puck News. Surprising as it may seem, Matt and I are not the only ones who banter. Desus Nice and the Kid Mero are all pro banterers on their late night show on Showtime. They also do sketch comedy and uncensored interviews that would make any broadcast standards and practices department quake. The Desus and Mero show has featured an array of guests from Denzel Washington and Amy Poehler to Anthony Fauci and Elizabeth Warren. Desus and Mero also like to set up interesting situations, like the time the pair took Seth Meyers day drinking at a Times Square barbecue restaurant known for its Texas-sized cocktails. That led to speculation on how those enormous drinks get made.
Let's just all picture in our head how big this blender is.
Oh,
it's huge.
It's the hugest. You know the ninja blenders? They have an actual ninja in there with like two like
it's
swords.
Be, right?
Because I figure it's big enough someone could possibly fall into it.
Yeah.
Like, that's a huge hazard in the back.
I bet that if you go in the back, there's a wall of, like, staff who've been lost to the blender.
Oh, yeah.
Desus and Mero launched their careers with observational tweets, which led to a podcast and a web series, and ultimately to their self-titled talk show, now in its fourth season on Showtime. I wanted to ask you, and maybe I'll direct this to Mero, to what degree, I mean, you guys have done a lot in the business and are doing more and more and more, but to what degree do you guys follow the business? Because I read that, you know, one of your goals in an interview you said was to replace the 65-year-old white dude and be the gatekeeper and say, this is a dope story. I want it to be heard. That is like, you know, it's an executive job, basically. But do you follow the ins and outs of this business?
Like, constantly. Like, rest in peace, Kobe Bryant. Like, I watch TV like it's game film now. I don't watch TV like it's entertainment. I watch it like it's game film. And, like, they could have done this better. They could have did this better. Or this is taking off. Or, you know, like, I'm reading, like, Variety, Deadline, Hollywood Reporter, all that stuff. Like, the unscripted, like, executive at, like, AMC was let go this week. You know what I mean? Like, I'm reading, like that. Like, you know what I mean? Right. So, yeah, no, like, I keep abreast of all that stuff.
So you guys grew up in the Bronx, both immigrant families. You go through this evolution that is sort of interesting. I know you did drudge jobs, and I won't spend too much time on that, although I'm sort of tickled that you both had to be writers at one point in your lives, like for publications, so you know what pain is.
Oh, yeah.
Desus, you worked for a magazine, and then Mero wrote reviews for Noisy. That Desus, did you kind of tweet your way out of that line of work?
Yeah, basically, I've always been on Twitter, so I've used it no matter what job I had. Even when I first started at Twitter, I was literally working in a nightclub, and I would only tweet between like 1 and 5 a.m. so no one saw the tweets. But then when I had this office job, it was just like such a soul-crushing office job that I basically turned it into like a text version of that show, The Office. I renamed all my coworkers and just gave them pseudonyms. And I would live tweet every day in the office about what was going on, because things that were going on, people could relate to them, but then they were just so over the top. For example, there was one day we had an 8 o'clock meeting to get us ready for the 9 o'clock meeting. And I pointed out, I was like, there's like so much redundancy. It doesn't make any difference. And then I tweet about, because like people would bring their relationships to work, or people would just do weird things and eat during conference meetings. And they'd be like, don't eat. And that would make people bring more food. So it was just like such a weird place. So I was like, if I'm going to go through this, let me at least make it funny and tweet about it. And, you know, but going through that led to give me content for the podcast. So, you know, at the end, I'm not mad at it. It kind of worked out for me.
Mero, you were going to be a science teacher, and you taught at your alma mater. We had, I don't know why the connection in my mind that we had Natasha Rothwell on the show a few weeks ago, and she too taught at her alma mater in New York. So apparently that is the way to get a career in show.
I guess so. Yeah. No, I mean, like it was definitely like a full circle moment for me to go back and work there. Cause I, you know, obviously like I attended the school as a kid, and the principal was a paraprofessional that worked with me as a kid. So, you know, going back there, it was just like going back to my old stomping grounds or whatever. But it became kind of hectic because in 2013, shout out to John Caramanica of the New York Times. I got featured on the front page of the arts and culture section. And I'll never forget this. Like, I'm walking into, like, and this is like old school. We're punching our time cards. Like, I punch my time card. I'm on my way to my classroom. And shout out to Mr. Skelly, John Skelly, the assistant principal. He sees me, 6'5" Irish dude. He looks at me, he has the New York Times in his hand, and he goes, "The kid Mero, huh? So we got a star over here, huh?" He's like, and he's just like, after that, he was breaking my balls all the time. I got called into the principal's office, and I had to make up this elaborate lie about how like my manager / creative partner, Victor Lopez, was banking and tweeting my tweets out throughout the day so that I wasn't tweeting on like company time, which like I used to do. Like I used to go to the bathroom and take like a 20-minute bathroom break.
Right. It was not me.
No, it wasn't me. It was my manager / creative partner. Like, it's him. Like, he's tweeting these out just to like, you know, keep the engagement up. I'm taking this very seriously, guys. Trust me.
So, you know, I tweet a lot, more than my bosses probably would want me to tweet, especially with opinion. Tell us how the transition from lots and lots of tweets to this starts to happen.
You know what? Lots and lots of tweets is cool, but then at the same time, sometimes you're just tweeting away and it's not getting you anywhere. And then sometimes you see people and they have really great tweets and they're basically just giving away genius ideas or genius jokes just for free. And then you don't even technically own your tweets after you put them up, you know, like because of the terms of services. But it definitely helped just like to quicken the mind and be quicker. So when you see something and coming up with an opinion with it. And then Twitter was kind of just how my brain worked. So to make the transition to the actual show to do the same thing was pretty simple. But without being on Twitter for almost a decade, I couldn't have done that. So it's just like, I'm kind of glad that I had said this earlier on, and I can't find this tweet. I said that the point of Twitter is to use Twitter to get off of Twitter. And I think I've accomplished that.
I don't know. Are you really off of Twitter?
Right now, I'm just taking a social media break for the summer because my therapist told me to do it. Because he was just like, you know, you've taken too much information at some point. That's what I was doing. I was like watching the news constantly, like flooding Twitter, reading this, reading Reddit. And he's just like, you just got to like do nothing for a second and just chill. So that's what I'm trying to do. It feels weird because I want to tweet everything. The last time I took a Twitter break, I was in the Bronx House of Detention because I was arrested. And what I remember is it was so wild in there and I kept wanting to tweet and I just naturally kept reaching for my right pocket where my phone would be.
Right.
Because I'm so used to tweeting anytime I see something. And that was the first time that gave me pause that I was like, wait a minute.
I feel like I would be committing a journalistic crime if, Jesus, I think you mentioned you couldn't tweet because you were incarcerated. I'm not sure why that happened. Can you just briefly tell me what went on there?
Basically, I was falsely imprisoned because a police officer in New York City said I pulled a gun on him. And long story short, the judge was like, he did not, and it basically got thrown out.
I have to say, I just cannot believe that the New York City police could come up with a mistake, right?
How
in the world could that happen?
I think it was a clerical error, like, you know.
So how do you go from that? Do you go and pitch? I'm not clear on how you move to having podcast web series. You know, you start out, I think, at Complex. Do you go to them? I'm missing a link there.
Oh, the link is shout out to our boy and the homie for life, Donnie Qua, who's been our friend. We've known him on the internet forever. And like, I know him from message boards. We would talk on Twitter, and he got a job at Complex making content. And he sends us an email. And he was like, yo, you guys, people love when you guys interact on Twitter. And would you guys like to do a podcast with Complex? And, you know, Complex has always been a cool branch out to Complex. And, you know, to do anything with Complex is wild cool. So to have a podcast, which honestly at the time, I had no idea what a podcast was. Like, I don't listen to them. I wasn't familiar with them. I knew everyone was like, they were the buzz at the time. But I was just like, all right, whatever the hell this is. And we went there, and I remember the first recording session, it was literally me, Donnie, and Meryl in a little room with like a Zoom H4N recorder. And we did a test run, and people loved it. And I remember playing the test episode for my sister and her friends while we were on the way to a party in the car. And they said, turn it off, because their makeup was starting to run because they were laughing so hard. And so it was just like off of that. And he had gold there. And Donnie, you know, took it higher up in Complex. And Complex loved it. But, I mean, it all starts with that initial email from Donnie. Like, he's like the guy who made the Backstreet Boys.
Well, those pivot points can be so important when you look back and you didn't know at the time. So you do that for a while, and you move to Vice. I mean, correct me, one
MTV.
Of you, if I'm wrong.
After Complex was MTV.
MTV2. Yeah. MTV2. Big difference.
Oh, yeah.
Big difference. Be clear on that.
Yes, MTV2. Okay. And I think at this point, you're having fun, you're learning, but your resources aren't there. And I don't know if Meryl wants to talk about this, or either one of you jump in, but the resources are not quite there for what you want it to be. Do I have that right?
Yeah, no. 100%. So the MTV2 thing, you know, it came through, and it was really kind of like, I always call it like undergrad for the industry. Cause when we got there, like, you know, we didn't know anything about making TV or doing anything like that. And the lack of resources was not actual tangible resources. Cause it's Viacom. They have a gazillion dollars, but it was a lack of, you know, structure. Like, what are we doing here? Are we here to pitch? Are we here to be talent? Are we here to just be locked into a contract? So there was a lot of sitting around, and a lot of like, there was like a this big notepad that we thought, like, you know, oh, we're in here. Shout to Victor Lopez. You know what I'm saying? Like, it was us three in there just kind of like coming up with ideas constantly all day, every day, boom, 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 thinking like, oh, these are all going to go. You know what I mean? And
right.
I think zero of them did. But then we ended up doing a show with Charlamagne. So, like, I say all that to say this, like, that was kind of like the training grounds for being on like linear television.
Yeah. It's funny because Viacom, you know, talking about the business and the shuffling of the business, you're at Viacom, you go to Showtime, which is CBS, which is, I guess, probably a separate company still at that point. Yeah.
And then it's like, hey, guys.
Presto change up.
Guess what?
And now we're all back. We are all back, baby.
Together again.
But you know what? That's like, that right there is like, that's a key example of, I always say this on the podcast, it's just Hollywood, baby. Like, you meet a person 6 years ago and you have a bad experience with them, you're going to run into them again at some point in this industry. So it's like a whole thing about learning how to navigate personality types, making friendships, making alliances and stuff like that. But then also, like, it's such a fluid industry. Like, you work for this company today. This company might dissolve tomorrow. This company might be acquired tomorrow. This platform your show is on might not exist at the end of the year. So, you know, you always have to, like, you know, read the trades and just be ready and be very agile to change on a moment's notice, because Hollywood moves really fast. And I don't think the average person realizes it.
Coming up after the break, Desus and Meryl explain why they can call Showtime and network president David Nevins, even if they don't want to. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes. Join Jacqueline Coley as she hosts a brand new podcast, Scene on the Screen. Meet the innovative people at NBC Universal as they share their journeys, inspirations, and the movies that define them. Each episode is an intimate and fun conversation about the impact of film. Scene on the Screen is available now wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. Comedians Desus Nice and the Kid Mero have progressed and diversified over the years, starting with jokes on Twitter and moving to podcasts, to web series, to their own show on Showtime. The series includes banter and interviews that range from broadly humorous to thoughtful and informative. In a recent warm-up for the show, posted on YouTube, the pair riffed on news of Lady Gaga being in talks to play Harley Quinn in a musical sequel to the Todd Phillips blockbuster Joker.
Also, Lady Gaga gives big Lower East Side art student vibes, so I feel like she would say yes to any musical.
Yes!
Doesn't matter where it's happening, in a theater, on the train. Yo. Y'all gonna get this.
She's rich, but she still owes Pratt like $1.5 million.
After gigs at Complex, MTV2, and Viceland, Desus and Mero say they are now happy to call Showtime home. So when you come to Showtime, Desus, you said somewhere they don't make you feel like circus monkeys that have to dance all the time.
Wow.
Did you say that?
You know what? That does sound like pre-therapy Desus. So I will run with that. No, Showtime, shout out to Showtime. They've been an amazing company, very listening. It's very easy to get in contact with anyone. Like, I can personally call the president, David Nevins, if I want right now. Would I do that? No, he would not like that. But, you know, it's like very, it's definitely, if you need something and you ask for it, there's going to be a conversation held. And if you really need something, you're going to get it. You get nothing but support. I'm not going to say they're loving because, you know, it's a corporation, but there's a general feel for concern about the content we make and the staff. And you don't generally get that in some of the other networks that we've had. Like, I've gotten emails about, like, is the staff being overworked? That kind of thing. And, like, other networks, they would not have given a shit about that. So, you know, like, we're very happy at Showtime. It's a good place to be. And I feel like we made the right decision coming here.
Yes, I think you learned early and don't trust love in Hollywood, but appreciate the courtesy when you find it. Appreciate it.
Listen, as they say, never trust anyone who falls in love in front of a camera.
Yeah. So.
I've never heard that before in all this time. Mero, one of the things I saw that you had mentioned about it too was promotion, which is so important in the cluttered environment we have today. You said they put the billboards everywhere. They put us on Metro cards. Which to a New Yorker is like being in the Bible.
Seriously.
Literally.
I don't know if you had to argue for that or they just.
No. I mean, like, there's idea. Like, earlier on, we would go, like, physically meet, you know, in the before times, you know, we would physically meet and have, like, these marketing meetings and, like, just talk about stuff. And then you go from there. You know what I mean? Like, you work with, like, you know, because that's the thing. Like, this show it's a unique show. You know what I mean? It's a unique show. It's a unique audience. It's a unique, you know, take on, you know, late night or a variety talk show. So the approach has to be different top to bottom. So, you know, even with the marketing, like, you know, at Viceland, they like Megan Kirsch and Nate Coonrod, all those guys over there. The marketing for that was brilliant because they did a lot with very little. It all was very like kind of very guerrilla style. So that, you know, that works. So it's just like kind of like if it's not broke, don't fix it.
I know that you want to have a message to some degree. You know, we don't want it to be an after-school special, obviously, but you had Fauci on during the pandemic because I think, Desus, you said that you had heard people in the neighborhood where you are saying the virus is fake and, you know, the message wasn't... I've heard those conversations myself. I always want to stop in the store and go, no, you have to get the vaccine.
You don't understand.
I'm sure that would be very welcome.
Honestly, you know, like early, you know, I was in the Bronx during the pandemic, in the South Bronx, and it was just there was so much misinformation about COVID, but at the same time, the South Bronx was hit so hard by COVID that I remember walking my dog and we used to pass the refrigerated trucks by Lincoln Hospital where they had to keep the extra bodies because the morgue was full of people. So, you know, you see that and, you know, we have a show and, you know, like they reached out and the idea that we have a platform and our audience could benefit from this, that was a no-brainer. And, you know, shout out to Dr. Fauci coming on. And that was like, also, we have been on hiatus because of COVID. So it was like a two-edged sword. It was like, yo, we're coming back. And also, here's some information for you. So people, even if they didn't want to hear Dr. Fauci, if they liked the show, they was like, all right, I guess I'll sit through this. And hopefully they learn something.
We had Chris Smalls on recently, and he was talking about the Amazon Labor Union and stuff like that, which is like not inherently funny. But, you know, sit down with him and we like banter, like as we said earlier. And, you know, funny stuff comes out of it. Because when you get, you know, three guys from similar backgrounds talking about whatever,
right,
it ends up being just organically funny. You kind of trick people into learning
stuff. What an amazing
stuff,
story, you know? He has. Yeah. Then you got the writer's room and then you got the showrunner. Does that make it a different world?
So it's so much, you know, like, because like our writer's room is some of the best in the business. Shout out to Heaven. Shout out to Rob. Shout out to Julia. Shout out to Josh. Shout out to Robert Hornhauser. You know, we have like some of the best writers right now for what we do because it's a different writer's room in that they don't write jokes for us. They put us in situations where they know we can be funny. So it's just kind of like, they're just like, hey, I'd like to see Desus and Meryl in the MoMA. And so, like, they'll create a situation off of that. So it's like a different writer's room than other. It's more freeform than other writer's room, but I think it's more fun. And the writers, they're having the time of their lives because they can pitch us crazy off-the-wall stuff. They're like, what if Desus and Meryl took Seth Meyers to go drink at BBQ's? Is there like any other show?
I think that is very fun. Yes, I would join.
Yeah, that would be, you know what? Watch it. Watch it. We might invite you to the next one. You know,
okay. But, I'll be there for it.
You know, like other shows, that's a 4-page script. For us, that's maybe 4 beats. Like, look, you know, so our writers completely get us. And shout out to JD, our showrunner, because he's come in and he's like kind of streamlined the process and made it quicker to make the show. And if the show is quicker to make, it's more fun to make. The staff is happier. Me and Meryl are happier. And I think that really comes through in season 4. You can definitely kind of feel a difference in energy from the previous seasons. But at the same time, the previous season was during COVID. So that's why it was probably a little heavier. But there's like a sense of levity and just like happiness now on the show that I think definitely comes through on camera.
Yes, we are very ready for that. You have your book, podcast, TV, radio. Somebody asked you, what's next, Meryl? You said, movies. That's next on tap.
Features, scripted. I feel like there's like a list, right? Like a list of things. Not that you have to do, but that if you do them and you do them well. So like, you know, a book, you do a book, it becomes a bestseller. Then you have the rights to that book. You turn the rights to that book into a scripted series, a movie, whatever, you know, and then you could just spin out from there.
Yes, milk that cow.
You know, hello. And, you know, I'm particularly interested in like the children's book space because it's like something that can create like an empire. Like, you know, I'm a father of four. So I see stuff like, you know, Captain Underpants or like Dog Man and stuff like that. And it, you know, it's not just a book. It's a book. It's a cartoon. It's merchandise. It's this. It's that. So it's just like a lot of avenues for you to, you know, create and make money. Because, you know, that's, you know, I go through a lot of fruit by the foot in this house. You know what I'm saying? And it has to be paid for somehow.
Yes, you have. Those bills must be paid for all that fruit by the foot. Desus Nice and the Kid Meryl are the hosts and executive producers of Desus and Meryl, which airs on Showtime Thursdays at 11 p.m. Thank you guys so much for joining.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us. This is
Kim Masters, ladies and gentlemen.
And that's The Business. Joshua Farnham produced and edited today's program with help this week from Matt Schwartz and Paul Smith, who also mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.